You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 19th of March 2018 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Emma Nelson, and coming up on today's programme, no surprises, Vladimir Putin is elected for a fourth term. The rest of the world raises an eyebrow. My guests James Boyce and Carol Walker will be talking about this and the day's other top stories, including no telling, White House staff are told to keep shtum with non-disclosure agreements lasting well beyond Donald Trump's time in the White House. We'll also chew over a particularly meaty weekend of tweets by Mr. President. And as a former World Cup winner runs to be governor of Rio, we'll ask if it helps to have good ball control when you're a politician. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Emma Nelson. So my guests today are James Boyce, the political historian specialising in the United States and its place in the world, and Carol Walker, political analyst. Welcome both to Studio One. We begin with a result that was never really in question. It was purely the margin of Vladimir Putin's victory in the Russian presidential election that was interesting. Winning a little over three quarters of the vote, President Putin comfortably demonstrated that at home at least he enjoys support, even if it might be of the ballot box stuffing bust-in variety. Let me begin with you, James. The rest of the world's leaders have, how should we describe this, been muted in their support today.
Yeah, and I think that, especially sitting here in London in the aftermath of the Salisbury story, that's to be expected. I think anybody who was surprised by this result really should get a grip, quite frankly, because there's no doubt about it. When you analyse it, Vladimir Putin has been in power now in the Kremlin for one way or another since, 1999, I'm going to guess, with the odd transfer to Medvedev in perhaps name only. So that's 20 years worth of leadership in Russia. When you couple that with the decision in China now that the leadership there is going to be effectively for life, you can start to see how it is that China and Russia are able to start putting into plan these ideas of grand strategies and long-term thinking, which is going to run rings around the West when we see how fractured the leadership here is in Great Britain, in Europe and in the United States.
You were nodding at that idea of the grand plans being put into place. The first thing that Putin's gang, their press gang, said yesterday is that this gives the president time to engage in the ideas and carry out those plans that he has for Russia. Did we have any clue what they might be other than he hung up his coat on Friday evening, went and campaigned for a bit, won the election, was back in behind his desk first thing Monday morning? No change.
Well, I think what's clear is that this is a man with huge ambitions who, I think, as James said, it has been running rings round the rest of the West. If you look at the fact that he got away with annexing Crimea, trampling over Ukraine, he is dictating the course of events in Syria. There is now at least a suspicion that, given the poisoning here in the UK of Sergei Skripal, that he is now taunting the UK, that he is to a degree testing the UK and testing the rest of Europe to see whether it can maintain solidarity in the face of further Russian aggression. And there does appear to be no limits to President Putin's ambitions. I think the difficulty for the West is that they simply are uncertain how to respond to this man who is defying many of the laws and the rules which they feel are part of international rule, and to a degree recognise just how powerful Russia is. When you have an American president who is more interested in his own territory, who's putting America first, does not certainly appear to want to stand up to President Putin at the very least, then I think that just simply reinforces this sense of President Putin that he's going to glide on through these next 6 years, do pretty much what he wants.
He has a brilliant way, doesn't he, James, of making the West put themselves on the back foot with the Skripal case. It was more than a week before Russia made any kind of comment, by which time the whole of the British parliamentary system had churned itself into turmoil. When there are issues about Syria using chemical weapons against its own people, the Russians then managed to put President Obama on the back foot. He has this reputation of making everybody feel as if it's up to them to decide what to do next, even though he seems to be the one pulling all the strings.
Yeah, you know, I've been fortunate to work with you guys here at Monocle for a good number of years now, and over much of that time period, we've talked about things like who should Time magazine name as Man of the Year? And I've routinely said, well, it has to be Vladimir Putin. Whatever you think about him, he has constantly, over the last 4, 5, 6 years, run rings around the leadership in the West, whether that's Obama, whether that's Trump, whether that's David Cameron, Theresa May, etc., etc., etc. And he's done so by constantly keeping the Western leaders one step behind. No one quite knows what he wants. Everybody seems to look at this and goes, well, it's about empowerment and about restoring some sort of sense of Russian prestige. And there's no doubt part of that. But he's so cunning, I think, in terms of making sure that the West is divided rather than united in any way, shape or form. And he's been very, very skillful, I think, at that. So quite frankly, you know, we can talk about, you know, who is running the West and et cetera, but I think that the most important politician in the world right now is Vladimir Putin.
James mentioned the idea of dividing other nations. I mean, all we need to do, Carol, is look at the European Union at the moment. If you are a populist in Italy, if you are right-wing in Austria, if you're right-wing in Germany, Poland as well, you know, there will be certain factions who are pro-Putin.
Indeed, and we've seen some of those far-right parties in countries you've mentioned, in Poland, in Germany, in Italy, praising Putin and congratulating him on his victory. President Putin said that he would like to thank Britain for increasing the turnout because of its reaction to the poisoning of Sergei Skripal. This is a man who is facing a huge amount of international pressure over the attack on Sergei Skripal, who is still, along with his daughter, lying in hospital after this poisoning by Novichok. And Russia has been effectively taunting the UK over this. We've seen Russian state television broadcasting stories suggesting that people should be a little bit careful if they went to the UK because it looked awfully dangerous the way, oh, people were being poisoned and, oh, other people who were perhaps opponents of President Putin fell mysteriously from windows of houses and got impaled on railings. And they managed to turn this into a mocking series of warnings to anyone considering going to the UK. President Putin, rather than appearing uncomfortable by the pressure that he is receiving from the UK and from most of the mainstream parties, it has to be said, in Europe, is reveling in this idea. He is clearly has turned the message to his own voters back across Russia that, look, it is completely outrageous the way the Europeans are pressurising us like this. I am the man who is in charge there. He has turned even this to his own advantage.
The Kremlin under siege as ever. But James, if you were sitting in a Baltic state, you know, putting your hand up and asking for NATO to notice you, how would you feel tonight about the fact that your neighbour, Vladimir Putin, is in charge until, what, 2024, if I'm right?
I think I'd be glad I was in NATO,
right,
to be very honest with you, because it's where the NATO and members weren't in NATO that there's been problems, because, of course, then you enter into the collective responsibility of Article 5. You know, the extent to which Britain might be able to trigger that, quite frankly, we've had an attack upon our own state. There have been a number of people who said, well, you know, if push comes to shove, you know, could you trickle that, you know, as a response against what Russia's doing? But I think that, you know, in an era in which, you know, these international organizations have come under attack and criticism for a variety of reasons, you know, we can look at NATO and say, well, you know, when push comes to shove, there is an extent to which the fact that there is that collective responsibility situation of Article 5 potentially has kept Russia's ambitions at bay and has done exactly what it was meant to do, which is to protect the weak against the might of the former Soviet Union.
Works beautifully on paper, but I wonder exactly how well that would really play out in reality. I mean, had that police officer who attended to the Skripals died as a result of his exposure to a nerve agent, that would have been the death of a British subject on British soil by what many are speculating is a Russian-sponsored agent. We look at Ukraine. not much has been done there.
Well, true, but that's my point, is that, you know, that wasn't part of NATO at that point, which is why the invasion happened and there wasn't much of a pushback. It's non-NATO nations which have felt the ultimate brute force of Russia. And perhaps we can look at the collective responsibility concept of Article 5 and say, well, at least that's theoretically worked with regard to that.
And I think that there is a sense in which President Putin is aware of the power of NATO. And it was when Ukraine was considering moving closer to the West, was flirting with this idea of closer ties with the EU and with NATO, that it triggered Russian action in Ukraine. So you have to suspect that surely even President Putin would hesitate to actually launch any kind of serious aggression against those Baltic states, because I think that there would then be some real pressure from NATO to take further action. And we have in recent years seen some pretty forceful exercises by NATO troops, which are still going on and still in position, within those countries. And I think, as James says, you know, if you're sitting in Estonia or wherever, you are pretty reliant on NATO at the moment. The one worry those nations, I think, must have is, of course, the man in the White House, President Trump.
Indeed. I mean, with the whole issue of the Trump involvement, the Russian involvement, the suspected involvement in the US elections of 2016, more of which a little later on this programme, it does allow Putin to exercise that plan that many people say, which is if you make other countries feel unsure, then your influence grows.
True, there's no doubt about that. Let me just throw this in the mix, however, which is that there is another way of looking at this, which is that after the end of the Cold War, the West, led by the US, was very, very aggressive in terms of expanding NATO into Central and Eastern Europe. And there were voices in the White House back then who did actually say, if we push this too far, too fast, it could very well trigger at some point in the future an aggressive response from the Soviet Union. Now Russia. I wonder whether we're perhaps seeing that.
Domestically, however, we talk about the way that the world is going to deal with Vladimir Putin, but we heard earlier on today on Monocle 24 from Mark Galliotti. He's a principal director of MIAC Intelligence and head of the Centre for European Security at the Institute of International Relations in Prague. He joined us on the line from Moscow. And he talked about a Vladimir Putin who, although on the international stage quite likes being the strong man, domestically may not have that much of an appetite for power for much longer.
On the one hand, Putin's got this massive more than three quarters of the vote. But on the other hand, actually, there is a pervasive sense that we are in the era of late Putinism, a sense that he's bored with the job. He's also getting on. And he's actually looking for a successor, one that will kind of protect his position and his legacy. But essentially, I think that although don't expect to see any change today, tomorrow or next week, I think from now the debate starts. What happens after Putin? So we are heading in the direction of change, but it's a process of years, not months.
What are your thoughts on that? A Putin who doesn't really want to do the job anymore? I'm not that convinced.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that he's thinking about retirement any day soon. He did joke today when he was asked whether he could, in the Chinese style, simply extend his term in power infinitely. And he's joked that he couldn't see himself doing the job when he was 100 years old. But that is an awfully long way off. You get the sense from Putin that this is a man who is certainly not thinking about retiring to his dacha anytime soon. He has clearly got big plans for Russia. He does have problems. The Russian economy is in difficulties. The sanctions aren't making life any easier, although they certainly don't seem to be inhibiting him politically. But clearly, he appears to me to be a man who certainly isn't showing his age. Maybe he's had a little bit of help there. Who knows?
He had lovely rosy cheeks last night, didn't he?
His skin is smooth, is it? Yep. He's looking well. He's looking ambitious. He's got a huge majority behind him, admittedly, due to the fact that there were no serious political opponents who were even allowed to stand. He has brutally oppressed any opponents inside Russia, as well as his opponents around the world. But I don't think this is a man who's looking at the end of his term in power yet. And I suspect he has a lot more that he wants to achieve in the next 6 years and maybe even longer.
And anyone who's ever been to Lenin's tomb will know how good they are at preserving their leaders. The time is 18:14 here in London, and we've all had them. The online survey where if you simply answer a few questions about your favourite pickled vegetable, you can find out whether you're loony left, far right, extreme centrist or apolitical. That may be a slightly frivolous take on things, but these surveys are billed as just that. But now Facebook finds itself at the heart of a scandal involving the mass collection of people's online personal information to create profiles. These profiles then become the target of adverts designed to influence the political vote. The agency apparently responsible for this is a firm called Cambridge Analytica, and there are claims now that they lied to the British Parliament about just how connected to Facebook they were. James Boyes, this is complicated than the telling, even more complicated to unravel.
It is indeed. I think we need to admit that, because sometimes these stories are very, very complicated and they are very, very difficult to try and to get to the bottom of, quite frankly. I saw there was a big plunge in Facebook stock today once this came out, which is interesting. The extent to which this will cause people to, you know, come away from Facebook is probably somewhat limited in this day and age when it's so ingrained in society. But I think that if it gives us reason to start thinking about what it is that people are putting on this website. I'm constantly warning my students, for example, about posting imagery and data on the basis that they're soon going to be going out into the job market, and the first thing people are going to be doing is Googling these applicants to see who they are, what they do, what they get up to. You know, we're almost living virtual lives now, and if these organisations, such as Cambridge Analytica, are now able to take this material, utilise it, weaponise it politically, for example, we can see how they've already got ties into Bannon's operation, the allegation that this goes to the extent of somehow trying to influence just a small number of the votes in the United States, potentially, which could very well have helped throw that election to Donald Trump, and as well as suggestions that they might have had an impact here with regard to the Brexit vote. You don't need to be moving an awful lot of people around to be making a huge difference, I guess, is the important thing to take from this.
Carol, all this story came from the whistleblower from Cambridge Analytica, a gentleman called Christopher Wiley, who described himself, or described what he was doing as creating Steve Bannon's psychological warfare. It's that great gap, isn't it, between that lovely little, or that mindless survey you do late at night, you know, what's your favourite sandwich, etc., etc., yet the knowledge that, or actually the innocence that we have towards what might be being done with that info.
Yeah, and although this is complicated, and although there is still a certain amount that has yet to be proven, what appears to have happened here is that there were some 50 million, mainly Americans, I'm surprised there were that many who were doing online personality tests, but there you go.
Lots of Americans.
Exactly. Who signed up to do these personality tests, and that their information, the wider information about their friends and family that they had shared on Facebook, was then passed on to this company, Cambridge Analytica, who used it as part of their efforts to help political campaigns, to help target voters on behalf of campaigns such as President Trump's election campaign. So this is a sense in which personal data appears to have been stolen, appears to have been used for political purposes. And I think it raises big questions for Facebook about whether it is doing enough to protect the information that put onto Facebook. And it does also cast a further shadow over the Trump campaign, because the suggestion here is that that campaign was helped by the use of information which was stolen without the data that was taken from people who went online perfectly innocently, who did not expect that data to be used as part of a political campaign.
And I think one of the more telling issues here is that time and again we keep hearing the same person being the point man in the campaign for that, and that is Jared Kushner. The idea that he's very much the point man in terms of the data, the metadata collection, and all this flowing into suddenly not just anybody, but the president's son-in-law. I think it's entirely feasible that Kushner himself is going to be the cancer on this White House. And it's telling, I think, that he's had his security clearance removed. If he was anybody else in that operation, he'd, in my opinion, would have been long since marched off the White House property.
We're not in that kind of sensible world anymore, are we?
But
we're not
in Kansas anymore. Also think, well, it's very true, but I also think if it was anybody else in this Trump White House, if it wasn't married to Ivanka, he would be removed, and I'm sure the lawyers would be telling him to do just that. But because of that family connection, it's going to be very, very difficult, if not impossible, for Trump to ease him out. If he does so, I think the way to do that is to move him away from the White House onto the 2020 campaign and make him campaign manager, for example.
But this comes at a time when political parties right across the world are recognising the huge importance of social media in targeting their voters. That's why this kind of thing matters. If you look back to the last couple of elections in the UK, one of the reasons that Momentum, this left-wing group that supports the Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn, was so successful in mobilising the support behind him was because it tapped into social media. It tapped into, in particular, younger voters who were not being reached by the traditional campaigns. And it was they were hugely successful in generating a huge amount of support and getting people out to vote who might not have voted otherwise. The Conservatives are now desperately here in the UK struggling to catch up, scrambling to try to get their own social media campaigns underway. And I think the reason this kind of thing is so important is because social media data is now a really, really valuable campaign tool if you're trying to get a certain candidate elected.
The time is 18:20 here in London. You're listening to Midori House with me, Emma Nelson. Joining me in the studio today, Carol Walker and James Boyes. Coming up next, we have another trip to the White House. Stay with us.
The Monocle Quality of Life Conference returns for a fourth year, and this time we're touching down in Zurich. Join Monocle's editors and a lineup of tack-sharp panellists for lively debate, informed conversation and top-notch hospitality. Whether you're an architect, city maker, retailer, media mogul or chef, pick up a ticket and be part of the debate on upping quality of life across the board. This year, there will also be a special focus on entrepreneurship and making it in the city. We'll be diving headlong into all Zurich has to offer, from fine food, Swiss wine and river swims, to private tours of the best shops and ateliers. So why not join us from the 28th to the 30th of June? Find out more and book your ticket now at conference.monocle.com.
Welcome back to Studio One. It's 18:22 here in London. You're listening to Midori House with me, Emma Nelson, James Boyes, the political historian specialising in the United States and its place in the world, and Carol Walker, political analyst, joins me in the studio now. Now, Republicans have urged Donald Trump not to go after the special counsel Robert Mueller after the president launched an unprecedented online rant against him. The Mueller probe should never have started, and there was no collusion, and there was no crime. He raged on Twitter. Well, Carol Walker, this was an interesting weekend, wasn't it? Again?
Yes, absolutely. And once again, Donald Trump letting us know through his Twitter feed his disdain for anyone who appears to be making suggestions of the Russian links to his presidential campaign. I think what's also fascinating here is the way that Donald Trump, another leader who appears to defy the traditional international rules, most world leaders would think that perhaps going after the man who's been appointed to look into this rather serious issue was a step too far. Donald Trump does not seem to be inhibited in any way now of targeting Robert Mueller. And this is after he's fired or forced out a huge succession of different advisors and key figures from his administration. Robert Mueller is the one figure who appears to have won respect across the political parties in the United States for the way that he is going into these allegations of Russian involvement, that he is carrying out a really detailed legalistic process, calling witnesses. We've seen some fascinating sessions before his prosecutors, asking the right questions, calling people to account. President Trump appears to be ready to dismiss his efforts just as he has any of his other opponents.
So are we at a position now, James, that it is a question of when and not if Trump tries to swing the axe at Mueller?
Well, it's interesting that Ty Cobb, his attorney, came out in the last 12 hours and said categorically that President Trump is not even considering firing Robert Mueller. We have seen an escalation, though, in Donald Trump's tweets. Up until now, he has stayed away from directly attacking Mueller personally. That has changed over the course of the last couple of days. He is now naming him and refocusing his attention upon the fact that people who are working with Mueller have a background as registered members of the Democratic Party as much as the Republicans. So he's clearly trying to tap into some suggestion that there is vested interests at work here against Robert Mueller's team. What is fascinating is we're seeing Mueller hand out more and more subpoenas, for example. It's getting closer and closer towards the center of power at the White House. I thought it was telling that we saw Lindsey Graham, someone who would, by most people's imagination, would be a conservative Republican, come out this weekend and say if there was an attempt to remove Mueller, that would be, in his words, the beginning of the end of the Trump presidency. Now, when you hear Republicans saying that, then you need to start worrying, quite frankly, because that obviously is Donald Trump's natural base. This is all playing very badly for the Republican Party in the polls in the US. We've seen a special election, which in theory should have gone for the Republican Party, go Democrat. There are leading polls which put the Democrats very far ahead heading into the midterms. And historically, those midterms would be bad for whichever party was in power. So if Trump loses control of the House and, dare I say, the Senate, then all of a sudden he is in very serious water.
And while he loses control, one arguably says, of his own ability to restrain himself online. At the same time, we're hearing reports that the White House staff, Carol, are being told to sign NDAs so that they do not necessarily just not talk about what happened inside the White House during the Trump presidency until the end of time they are barred from talking.
Well, clearly this is a man who's well aware that there are already an awful lot of characters who had senior roles in the White House who've been pushed out one way or another and have some pretty fruity stories to tell. Again, President Trump seems to want to simply ignore most of the rules, the laws of the land. If you look at Robert Mueller is somebody who, as I understand it, was technically appointed by the Attorney General as an independent prosecutor. Donald Trump simply doesn't care about that. He's looking at ways to get rid of him. He's recently just sacked the Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson. That came after Gary Cohen, which came after this whole string of senior figures in the White House who have been booted out. We've already seen the furore about one of the books that came out that described some of Donald Trump's behaviour. And clearly, he's worried about that. Perhaps he's right to be worried, but you would imagine that there must be plenty of characters in the White House thinking, come on, this is a step too far. America is supposed to be the land of the free, freedom of speech, binding their tongues for life. Will an American president really get away with that?
And it's a pretty leaky ship anyway. Finally, a successful footballer in Brazil may enjoy near godlike status both during and after his principal career. And so perhaps it's no surprise that if people love you now, you can do no wrong in whatever you decide to do next, even if your brains are in your feet. Well, in Brazil, the World Cup winning player Romário has decided he's going to run for the position of governor of Rio de Janeiro, which got me thinking, James, do you have to have good ball control to be a politician?
Well, there's no doubt about it. I think that what you're seeing is a continuation of what has its origins perhaps in the United States, which is that if you go into an election campaign with great name recognition, then you have a huge advantage over whoever your opponent is. People often talk about Ronald Reagan, for example, leading this. You know, he obviously was a leading B actor, if that's not a contradiction, back in the day before he became governor of California. Arnold Schwarzenegger followed him in that pattern. Clint Eastwood the same. This is all in California, I would point out. We've even had wrestlers like Jesse Ventura, for example, entering into political life in the US. We haven't quite seen Ricky Gervais running for office here in the United Kingdom, but I'm sure that day isn't far off.
Okay, finally, very briefly, we've just had the news that Miranda from Sex and the City, Cynthia Nixon, has announced she's running for governor of New York. What do we think of her chances are?
Well, I think this is fascinating. I think this is part of this whole anti-establishment, anti-politics mood. People are looking for somebody who can lead them, who they think is different, who they think that they can relate to, who can bring a bit of pizzazz, who can bring a little bit of flair.
Cynthia Nixon?
Well, she is somebody who has managed to convince... She is somebody who, to ordinary Americans, they can look at as somebody who is not a career politician. Look at this happened across the world. We were talking about Arnold Schwarzenegger there. Imran Khan in Pakistan. Gary Kasparov in Russia. We've had astronauts who have become senior politicians. People are looking for something different in their politicians. I think they're tired of the established figures. They think that they've got it all sewn up and they're looking for somebody to break that mould.
And it's the girl from Sex and the City. James Boyes and Carol Walker, thank you very much for joining us here at Midori House. Midori House is at the back at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 London time for now. From me, Emma Nelson, goodbye. Thank you for listening.